Gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you.
Welcome to the Patterson Press team. So you have the floor. How would you like to proceed?
Thank you, Commissioner. Our submission is relatively straightforward and simple. I'm quite happy to talk you through the specific details of bits and pieces of it, or quite happy to answer questions from the committee.
Well, we're obviously the bridge of evidence. You're not the only spinner that presented maps with strange holes in them. That obviously raised interesting questions. So perhaps if we just go straight to questions, and the question I asked Mr. Edgar, who appointed, as I say, appeared this morning with a not quite exactly the same series of maps, but something pretty similar, is I haven't checked, but I'm assuming that there are no submitters who have asked to enlarge the way Pedro areas.
Except perhaps us.
Tell me more.
Okay. One of the examples that we have included in the examples, actually two of them, on 4.4, which is on page 12 of the evidence. They're exactly the same, but slightly enlarged.
Bigger and easier to read.
Yep. There's an interesting gap in the Waitapuna areas between Lake Wanaka and the start of the Clutha River. That looks to us to be an obvious error, and an area where there should be Waitapuna, but that's not shown on the maps. And then the other one that we've picked up is the next map, 4.5, where the Waitapuna area runs down the centre of the river. These to us look like obvious mapping errors.
Refresh my memory as to what exactly your relief.
The relief was that the extent of the Waitapuna areas be reviewed and the location within individual sites be confirmed.
Check it.
Confirmed.
Yep.
That might be a stretch. The question I asked Mr. Edgar this morning is, are any of the mapping errors, or apparent mapping errors you've identified, to your mind, not minor errors, such that we could recommend they be corrected over the 16th? Are any of them that are substantive and correction would prejudice anybody?
Well, if you're trying to protect the river corridor, for example, say the Clutha River, I think in that case, if it's clear that that's the intent of what you're trying to protect, I suppose you'd have to define what is the river corridor and how wide should it be. But that might be an area maybe where, if that's the intent of what's being protected, could explore that. That would account for perhaps the difference from the Lake Wanaka to the outlet to the Clutha River, for example, and the cutting on the corner at Dean's Bank, which is 4.5, where it should logically extend over the whole river. You got any other examples there, Duncan?
4.7 similar.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, there's another example, I think, as well, in the Cadrona. I mean, probably fairly irrelevant in some cases, but in our opinion, kind of calls into the question the accuracy of the mapping overall. If those errors have been made, where else have other errors been made? For example, we gave some in the Cadrona, which map is that?
4.10.
our map 4.9 that we showed along the map, Riverbank Road, where the zone actually extends into three private properties for no real obvious reason that we can see, as compared to the ones next door. And also, looking at from my mapping experience, as to how that line's been drawn in GIS, the accuracy of it could vary anywhere from 10 to 50 metres, potentially, in the way that you see it's got like a bubble kind of line type, how best to explain it. As you draw an area, you usually do it as a series of lines or polygons, but you can choose a function in a lot of mapping programs, which we often use it for a revision cloud, where if you've made a change to a plan, you might put a bubble cloud around it and say, you know, this is revision one. But you could also use that as a mapping tool for denoting an area. You go along and it creates a series of arcs. Now, if you set the width of that arc to 20 or 50 metres, well, there's your accuracy. That's not very accurate. It could bubble out, come in, and go along. And as you're drawing it, if you click, especially if you've been drawing a large scale and you've been working on it for a long time, you could be tired, you could click on one area, and to start again sometimes is quite annoying in the mapping program. You have to go back and then you've got to join the arcs, but you might go along, it might bubble out, but you go, oh, just carry on. And so it can quickly lead to some areas where it balloons out for no obvious reason, and especially if you're tracing over perhaps a highlighted map in the program, without going back and then looking at the accuracy of that and making amendments to it. That's my opinion. That's in some cases that's how we've ended up with what we see as what would be a right term.
Some of these mapping issues appear to be because the uniform setback's been applied, and like I'm looking at 4.11. Seems that the rivers have got a kink in it and the Wayne Tupin has gone around it, or am I misreading it?
It does look to have a defined setback, but then that doesn't look to be consistent throughout the entire length. Like, for instance, to the left of that left arrow that I've drawn on there, there's a whole series of little kinks in there, which are indicative of that mapping that Mike's just been talking about.
Right.
Yeah.
And then looking at map 4.9, if it was to follow a river corridor, you'd perhaps pick up the edge of the terrace bank or the edge of the river, or you can see in that map the braided river. You might trace along the edge of the braided river and then offset 10, 20 metres or whatever margin you're looking for. But in this case, it goes out something like probably 50 or 60 metres, whereas immediately to the north and south, it doesn't. So maybe in some cases that offset method's been used, but in others it hasn't.
There's another component to your question as well, and that is, I don't see there's a particular issue if you're reducing the extent of the Waitapuna areas, but if, to take, say, 4.9 as an example, and that you find that the most appropriate location for the extent of the Waitapuna areas is, say, the terrace scarp in that area there, which is broadly denoted by the band of vegetation that you could see that essentially runs parallel with Riverbank Road. If you were to do that, you're including more areas in the Waitapuna area than were originally notified, and at that stage you're straight away asking questions of, is this a change that you can make as a minor correction, or does it need to be re-notified?
I would have thought that if there is additional private land covered and there's no submission, that's a variation. That's just off the cuff, without consulting my colleagues.
And that would be my take on it as well.
Commissioner, any questions?
Just, thank you. Paragraph 3.10 of your talk about
I'm struggling to think of an example of a similar situation and would question why you would map it if it wasn't significant enough to have rules associated with it. And then also, why have objectives and policies that aren't then implemented through provisions of the district plan?
So your advice to us, or your recommendation, is if there are no rules to be applied, and your substantive position is they shouldn't be able to do an area anyway, they should just be simply removed, that's your view?
Professionally that would be it, but I can also see it from the iwi side, is where else do you map these things to indicate to residents that there are sites of significance and that they should be considering?
So just following that, so where did that, I mean, to your paragraph, you were saying that it shouldn't apply, so your position is they should be removed, or they should be used, if we accept the recommendation, no rules, they should remain, but they have no rules to apply.
I don't think in that case you should have rules or objectives and policies that aren't implemented through the plan, so they shouldn't be there.
One answer might be that, and this is the answer that the Ms. Pickard's given us, is that if a rule trigger, any rule trigger, is brought into play that would cause an application to be a full discretionary or non-complying activity, then those objectives and policies would come into play. That would be a way in which those values could be given effect.
It would be, but why are they so significant that only apply if it was a discretionary or non-complying activity? Why would they not apply to a controlled or restricted discretionary activity? Yes, you might be talking about some form of commercial activity. But in that case, your effect on the Waitapuna wouldn't be contingent on what the activity was. You'd expect that the effect would arise whether it was residential or visitor accommodation or commercial.
I can understand the logic of what you say, but there is a sort of an element of throwing both the baby and the bathwater out, that if the Renaka have in effect compromised so as to reduce the regulatory burden in urban areas, the logic you're advancing would suggest, well, having compromised that far, they've accepted that implicitly that they don't get anything, which might seem a bit on the nose. Mm-hmm. Whereas if they're hung tough and see if these values are important, that they should apply to every activity, the reverse logic would be say, well, that's fine. Isn't it inherent in the balance of cost and benefit in Section 32 that you might get some halfway house that isn't entirely logical, but is a pragmatic compromise?
That's a very fair statement.
Commissioner Smith. Any questions for these?
Yeah, thank you. I'd just like to cast your mind to the practicalities, I suppose, of administering or applying for consent for such an activity under these rules. And I just wonder whether you might have some idea, well, how would you go about undertaking an assessment of effects for an activity on values that you
We do that already, and in such cases we go and engage with the appropriate iwi authorities and commission their input.
Yeah,
I was just saying that in such cases we engage with the appropriate iwi authorities and seek affected party approval from them, and in most cases that affected party approval has been granted.
That's what you have done in the past for similar activities?
It is, and I'd expect it will continue under these provisions.
So you would be heavily reliant on the iwi to identify the effects and help determine those in your assessment?
We do, and yes, that's the way we expect to continue doing it.
Okay, thank you. That's all I've got for now, but thank you.
Mr. Dawson.
Thank you very much for your feedback and explanation. It was very helpful. Just one small thing that came to my attention. You pointed out that, say, the 10 cubic metres of earthworks, that is counted as a combination of the cut plus the fill.
It is.
So in some instances, it's actually a smaller amount than you might think, in other words.
It's half that amount.
Yes.
Yeah, if the cut and fill.
And then the fill goes somewhere else on the property, you have to count them. If it's 5 cubic metres, then you're cutting it from here and filling it over there, that counts. You have to add it up.
Yeah, and that would break the threshold.
Yeah. Yep. I mean, in your experience for doing sort of regular activities like scraping a house site or whatever, 10 cubic metres, which has to cover the cut and the fill, is that quite small?
That's very small, even for a standard house on a flat site.
Even on a flat site?
Yeah. And I gave the example in the evidence of 2 truckloads would break that threshold. There's about 7 cubic metres per truck.
1 cubic metre cut from another. One truckload cut on another filling, and that's that.
And that's it, yep.
All right, thank you very much for that clarifying that. I'll just clarify one thing in
the 10 cubic metre threshold, as it's written in the rules at the moment, applies in all areas, all Waitapuna areas, not just urban.
Yeah.
It is rural as well.
Yes, I realise that. I'm sorry, it was just that the way it followed on from the paragraph above, I wasn't sure if it was referring to all or just the urban areas that you're saying.
It's both.
Yes.
Yep.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Min, for coming to see us. Much appreciated. I think we'll see you again for the conclusion at this stage.
Just sort of trying to get a bit of a clue as to what's going on with the actual procedure that you're doing. So, Just to give you a bit of background, I'm not a lawyer or a town planner or anything, just a resident of Velvet Town.
But you're still very welcome. I emphasise that.
Our families been in the Upper Clutha since the 1860s and in Albert Town since 1904. So this that I've written here is to be taken in conjunction with the other two submissions I made in October 2019 and May 2000. I hadn't seen Ms. Pickard's Section 42A report when I wrote the last thing, the last submission, and that my submission basically is that the privately owned land shouldn't be part of the Te Waipuna boundaries. But I think mainly it's to do with the fact that with the buildings and that are in place there, any sort of spiritual or whatever connection that the Ngāi Tahu might have had to the land has disappeared by the fact that it's that the areas that I'm talking about are all built up except for a section of land owned by the Ellises at the bottom end of Allison Avenue Gun Road intersection. So I'll just go past Mr. Pickard's thing. The Manawhanua question to ask, who are these people or persons? Upon what do they base their decisions? Is it cultural, spiritual, historic or traditional values? How long have they lived in the Albert Town area in the present or past to determine their position? I've read that the Ngāi Tahu have stated that they use the river for camping, food gathering, safe harbours and landing places. The food gathering areas in Albert Town have been recognised and designated under the Settlement Act as being on the Hawea River downstream from my property and the properties that I've mentioned in the submission. Any safe harbour, as far as my property is concerned, would be about 300 metres north or 300 metres south, because there's about a 25-foot vertical bank, which wouldn't have been easy to either moor or to get access to the land above. The area that's there now, today, does not resemble what it would have been like just prior to 1999, when the floods and the remedial works afterwards had a major impact on the area, but provided a lot more flat land than what there is there. The land on the river bank that is there, the unbuilt on land, is designated legal road. And although it's been highly modified, it may retain some of those values that the Ngāi Tahu are trying to retain. But I'd say that all the area that's been built on is substantially changed from the values that Ngāi Tahu hold. And I'll just make the comment that the Hikawai subdivision, and if you go back to Patterson Pitts map, I think it's on, which map was it? On 4-5, that's the section of land that you see there with the buildings on it. That was gifted to Ngāi Tahu at the time of the 1998 settlement. Ngāi Tahu did actually apply to subdivide it themselves, but it was declined. They then sold it to a private developer who carried on and did get the subdivision. It sort of surprised me at the time with the value that they placed on the land, why they sold it in the first place. But and I would think if the Waipuna designation was applied as it is further down, it would have gone into some of that subdivision as well. I just can't understand the reasons why it wasn't, or why they didn't suggest to do it. So really, if we just go down to the actions requested, very similar to what I made last time, that the the first one that Ms. Pickard's evidence be overturned as to where the boundary should be. She's saying that the property boundaries are not the values that Ngātahu had put on that. So it'd be overruled so that the land and private ownership and developed should be taken out of the area, out of the thing, and then to consult with Ngātahu to see if we can get a designation that suits them and the property owners. Initially, when I made my submission, it was on behalf of myself, but after I put it in, I found my neighbours were not aware of the designation was on their land and fully support me in the submission I made. And the other thing is that the bank, since 1999, there's been a history of subsidence, and the Otago Regional Council have done remedial works on the bank. The bit and directly in front of my property, which is right beside the bridge in Albert Town, was repaired in about 2002, and it seems to have done the job. There's been no further problems there. But at the other end of that bank, just as recently as last December, when the river was high, there's a certain amount of the bank has slipped away, and the Regional Council was looking at doing remedial works. Of course, the close down, the lockdown that we had interrupted their investigations there, so I'm not sure what stage it's at. But I believe that they should have the authority to make whatever repairs, emergency or otherwise, and this designation would be another barrier to them in doing that work. And then just to adjust the map accordingly. Most of those actions requested is what I did in the second submission, but it's just to put it in front of you again.
Thank you, Mr. Hebbard. Question for you. Like, I understand the point you're making about the flood protection works, and we've heard already from Otago Regional Council, and not put too fine a point on it, this wasn't a point that was of concern to them.
Okay.
And like, I understand that your neighbours and people who are directly affected. But I suppose we're thinking, well, I'm thinking, can't speak for my colleagues, if ORC aren't particularly bothered, why are you? And maybe you don't need to be.
Well, that could be true. You know, unfortunately, neither you or I can predict what might happen to that in the future. And if something does happen, we want to be able to deal with it or have it dealt with in a timely manner. And I was concerned by the designation and the consultation that would have to go with that could take time where actual work is needed. Thanks.
Mr. Dawes?
No, thank you.
Thank you.
And appreciate you coming to see us, Mr. Gibbard, and I think we've got the message loud and clear, as you say, you've been good enough to crystallise it for us again. And so thank you for your time. I don't have any further questions for you.
Thank you. Thank you for listening. I appreciate that. With all this, like the amount of time and paper that I've generated in just doing my little bit, I feel that you have, like this, publication after publication, and I thank you for your time and trust that you'll
make money.
Yes, I can imagine.
Just large pile.
Seeing we've finished early, that you might be able to go and have a quiet refreshment of your choice and just get the actions of the day out of your head for a bit and just come back ready tomorrow for another go, I suppose.
Yes, we will adjourn until 9 o'clock tomorrow. Back. fit and keen.
I'm glad.